It's Richard Mackey with the UBC Law School History Project. It's the 1st of February 2013 with Graham Zilm is here, and we're interviewing Rafe Mayer. Rafe, I thought we could start. Before the interview, we talked a little bit about your four grandparents, and that seemed like a nice, a good place to start. Could you go back there for
sure? It's interesting, Richard. I guess we all, of course, have four grandparents, and I think the majority of us have grandparents that are reasonably close to where you were born. But mine, one was born in Salisbury, England. One was born in Cape Breton Island, Nova Scotia. One was born in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the other one was born in Auckland, New Zealand. So that's quite a coming together.
And how did they all meet?
You know, it's sad. I don't know for sure. I know that my grandmother from Salisbury, she went out to New Zealand as a young girl with her father, who was a medical doctor, and how she met my granddad, Pop, as we call him, I really don't know. But the family came from New Zealand here in 1913 because my great-grandfather, Dr. Coates, the husband of my, the father of my grandmother. He, like most doctors, had a rather interesting view of business. And he moved here because he heard the streets were paved with gold and they would all come here. Now, my grandfather, who was born in Minnesota, they were just passing through. They were of English stock from Isle of Wight. And as a matter of fact, his great-grandfather was one of the people who signed the Punch table in the Punch Tavern. He was an editor of Punch magazine back in those days. And how he met my grandmother, who came out here on the second CPR train from Nova Scotia, I just don't know. I've often wondered, but I don't know.
What were some of the names of the... can you tell me the... obviously, your dad's family's is Mayer. What was the other... your mother's family? Was it Coates?
No. We'll start off with my dad's side of the family. His grandfather was Dr. Frederick Coates. His grandmother was named Blanche Coates. And she went by the nickname Phil all her life because she played some part in an actress in a play or something. On the other side, my maternal grandmother, who was Jane MacDonald, was from Prince Edward Island and from Nova Scotia, I'm sorry, and was... a Scot right down to her shoelaces. And my grandfather, Leonard Lee, as I say, they were passing through Minnesota, I think, at the time, running there for a short time, and he was born there as an American. And as I say, how they got together, how my Graham and, as I call them, my Gandhi got together, I really don't know. But they must have been reasonably well off because they lived in the West End at the time, which is where the well-off people lived. And my mother went to Crofton House school, and they had this might interest you. They had a summer home at Jericho Beach, and they would take the streetcar up to Broadway and Granville, what is now Broadway and Granville, and the man with the horse and buggy would come and pick them up and take them up to their summer home. And my grandfather had a little putt-putt. He used to putt-putt across English Bay and go to the Jericho. And a little later than that, they had their summer home in Caulfield and down on the water. That was before, of course, the Lionsgate Bridge was built, so it was pretty raw land. And they had a place, my grandfather had a place at Langford Lake in Victoria, near Victoria, and I only know that because he used to tell me about it, not very much, but there is a Lee Road which he actually built, and it's still there. So that's sort of, nobody came here with chains on or under orders with the court or anything like that. They all came voluntarily.
So they were part of that pre-First World War migration.
That's correct.
But I call it the Great Migration to BC because it was such a volume of people.
It was. And it was interesting that we were talking about Jean Barman's book, The West Beyond the West, and as she points out, the demographics here are very much different than from other provinces because while there were people came from Eastern Canada here, the bulk of them came from the States or from the Far East. And it had a much different sort of flavor to it than the prairies, which of course had Ukrainians and others come over, and the European population basically came from Ontario, etc.
So the you said that one branch came on the was your mother's side came on the second CPR train.
Yes, yeah, my grand.
So that's 1886.
Thereabouts, yeah. Thereabouts.
And what did they what did they do? What was their?
You know, I know what my father did. I know what my father's family did, but I don't know what Gandhi did. I suspect he had something to do with insurance. But in any event, he retired during the Depression, and I gather was pretty short of funds when he did. And he bought a farm in Burnaby, would you believe? And it's hard to believe that you have a farm now, but we used to go there on Sundays and drive for miles and miles and miles to get to Gandhi's farm. And it wasn't a big farm. It was mostly chickens. And I'll tell you a little story. I hope I'm not using up too much of your time.
That's fine.
He had a Banty rooster, and this rooster used to chase me and just raise hell with me and scared the pants off me. I guess I was probably about 9 or 10. And Gandhi took me out to the nearby woods, and he cut off a sapling from a maple tree and made a slingshot for me. He said, next time Jigs bothers you, take a shot. So he got back, and he had one of those cinder pathways in the days we used to have cinder from coal furnaces. So I picked up a piece of that cinder, and lo and behold, the Jigs came into range, and I nailed them right in the ass, and there were feathers flying all over the place, and Jigs never bothered me again.
That's it. And your mom, the coat side, what were they, in Vancouver early on too?
No, my mother is on the Lee side, L-E-I-G-H, and the MacDonalds. And they were, as I say, an old Isle of Wight family. She worked for the Vancouver province for many, many years on what was then the social page. And I don't know what more I can tell you. She had probably contributed a lot to me in the sense that she read to me a lot when I was a child and encouraged me to read, and always had good stuff lying around the house, like the New Yorker and Time magazine for my father, whatever it was. So I became a voracious reader of public affairs back when I was just a child. In fact, when I was in grade 7 at St. George's School, I got the school prize for general knowledge, and I was only grade 7. So I spent the war very interested in what was going on. I had maps up on my wall plotting the different armies and so on. And I was in the Army Cadets by compulsion at St. George's, but I also joined the Sea Cadets because I wanted to be a sailor. So I was very much involved in all of that as a youngster. And never dreaming what I know now, that we were just the next line of cannon fodder. You know, it just never occurred to me that was happening. And it became clear when I remember bayoneting bags of straw and learning how to twist the bayonets so, you know, make it all more difficult. So I don't know how I got into that, but...
But you were just too young, though, for the
I just
war.
Missed it, and I was just about 14 when it ended. And I was really, really, really pissed off that it ended without me getting into it. And then 4 years or 5 years later, there was a war in Korea, and I wanted no part of it. I learned an awful lot in that last 4 years. They want to kill you, you know. So some of my John Fraser's, one of them, and others that I knew, went into the service, and I don't think John ever went to Korea, but some of the guys I knew went in the Navy to Korea, but I wanted no part of it.
So did you grew up in Vancouver, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
Where did... It was your house.
Well, for the most part of my youth, we lived in what is now Caresdale, 6389 McCleary Street. And it's near McDonald and Marine. It's just one street over. Mm-hmm. And we had a huge woods behind my place where my pal Dennis Hargrave, who was living on the other side of it, he and I played there, and we drilled our troops and our gang that we had fighting Hitler, and all ready to fight, etc. And up at the top of the hill, there was a working dairy farm. And it was owned by Baroness Van Steenwyck, S-T-E-E-N-W-Y-C-K. During the war, then Princess Juliana, who was living in Ottawa, came out to visit Baroness. And somehow all of us kids had Dutch flags. I don't know where the hell they came from. We're all waving these little Dutch flags as Princess Juliana came by. But of course, the place is much changed now. It's all, the woods is gone. And, you know.
Was this the McCleary farm that was the farmhouse that was demolished in the 50s? And there was a bit of a controversy.
That would have been at the foot of what they call McCleary Hill, down on the flats. Huh. And so it was. That would have been perhaps a mile or so from our place. But I should tell you, my friend Dennis and I have the great distinction of being the first nude bathers at Wreck Beach. And we used to take our bikes down there, and we would swim. And one day, we went out to the hulk that was there, and we found the anchor. And it was a whacking big fin. It was one of those, I should know my anchors, but I don't know. But it's one like Popeye used to have on his arm, that kind. And we got that damn thing up the hill, onto the highway. And we put it between our two bikes and walked it back to my place, which was, it would have been a mile and a half, 2 miles. We took that thing back, all the way back. It took hours to do. And as we got it back and we dumped it on my front lawn, my father arrived home and he said, what the hell are you going to do with that? Well, it never occurred to us what we're going to do with it. The object was to get it, I guess. So we threw it next door in a vacant lot. And I've often wondered whether or not the people came to develop that. Suddenly thought they'd found the anchor belonging to a mysterious voyage by Drake and so on. So we wound up with the anchor. Yeah. Maybe it's still there for all I know.
I bet there's a story there.
Well, it was a fun time in many ways. We used to go down to the Musqueam Indian Reservation to fish. And we fished in a little stream there they called Tin Can Creek. It's actually Musqueam Creek, but we would fish for a little fish, I guess, about 4 or 5 inches long. I didn't know then, but now I would say they're probably cutthroats, you know, cutthroat. And we're down there one day, and a young Indian kid, I guess about 16 or 17, came along with a gaff. We watched him as he went over the other side of the river, and just a stream. A stream was perhaps 25, 30 feet wide at most. And he went down on his hands and knees, and all of a sudden, a gaff went in the water, and he came up with a kobo salmon. Mm-hmm. It was probably 4 or 5 pounds. Mm-hmm. And we gasped at this. I think we'd have been scared to fish if we'd known there were fish like that in there. Mm-hmm. And he went a little further up the river, and he did the same thing, got two of them. And he gave me one. When I got it home, my old man was going to give me a licking. He thought I'd stolen it. Mm-hmm. But what it did, it sort of blends into my later life. It made me understand that the coho salmon, unlike other salmon, doesn't breed en masse in uprivers and into streams. It goes into all kinds of little streams, creeks, ditches, farmers' ditches, and so on, which is the reason we've lost so many of them here. You know, the developers would say to City Hall, well, there's no appreciable fish values here. Mm. And that would ignore the fact that perhaps 10 coho came up, and, you know. And it sort of goes back to the Musqueam Indian Reservation. They have kept that river up, or restored it, I'm not sure which. So it's one of the few rivers in the Georgia Strait region that still has returning coho.
I come from a fishing background as well. My family had a school in Vernon.
That was Mackey School?
Yes.
Oh, my goodness me. Yeah. I know a lot of guys that went there.
Yeah.
And Rattlesnake Island was nearby.
Yes.
Oh, sure. Yep. I know. Yep. A lot of guys went there.
Well, we interviewed Harry Bellerman.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Harry's still alive and well, is he?
Yes, he's 80. He was born in 27. So yeah,
I was going to say he was alive and well and in the Second World War. And I knew Harry because he was a cricketer, and my father was a cricketer coming from New Zealand, and not very much cricket was played, but Harry was one of them. And I remember when he left to go to war, very well. That's why the Christopher Lurings are a very old family in this part. These parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the youngest of three sons, or four. The others are gone. He's the only one left.
Yeah, I was.
But he's doing very well.
I'm glad to hear that. Glad to hear that.
But he was there at the Mackey School. But they were fishermen too. They were, in fact, I inherited some of their fly rods. They had these Hardy.
Oh yeah, sure.
And in fact, they're in the museum in Victoria now.
I've got two Hardy split cane rods. One a 16-foot double handled salmon rod. Another one a 10-foot fly rod.
The salmon rod must be a pretty skookum.
It is. They're not in the house. I used to have them in a larger house. I had them in my den, but now they're stored out. I've got no place for them. As you can see, this place is so small that if I want to buy a box of beer, I got to take a box of empties out.
So, where did you went to St. George's?
I started off in Maple Grove. I was there from grade 1 to 4, and then during the war, later part of the war, I went to St. George's. I was there. I arrived there in grade 5, but I was immediately by Christmas time. I was pushed ahead to grade 6. So I stayed there until I'd finished grade 9, and then I went to Prince of Wales in Shaughnessy.
And then straight to UBC?
Straight to UBC. I got through first year fine. I flunked second year. It perhaps had something to do with the fact that I didn't write any exams. I'd found girls and golf and beer and all of the great joys of a fraternity life where nobody bothered me, and I just
by this time it's the early the late four
we're talking probably 49-50 was the first year. 50-51 had been the second year. That's the one I flunked. My father was much better about it than he should have been, I guess, in justice. He told me that I'd go back to university. But that if I didn't, do reasonably well, I was up to work. And so in second year, I got through second year, like a second class average, nothing brilliant. And then I had to have third year to go into law, and third year was fine. I got I needed a 65% average, and then I got into law school. But I'll tell you, it was a near-run thing. In all of that time, I'd never been able to pass French 202, which was mainly because I wasn't interested. No more complicated than that. They would have a book that you would read for the year, and then all the de la day, all the rest of it on the exam. And so I decided I there's no point in me writing it in third year. I hadn't been to a single lecture. And I'd made arrangements with Dean Gage that I would come to summer school to take it. And when the exam came, I was sitting down in the cafeteria, and a lady girlfriend of mine came along and said, "Aren't you studying for the French exam?" And I said, "No." She said, "Well, why not?" I said, "I haven't been to a single class. I don't even know the name of the book we studied." So at Val de Nuit by Saint-Exupéry, I said, "It's a great, small, short story, and I have it in English. I have an English copy. Maybe if you read that, you could read it in an hour, maybe you'd be able to fake it on the exam." So I read it, and lo and behold, in the exam, the first question for 75 marks out of the 150 was, "Please give a précis in English of Val de Nuit." Well, I could damn near reproduce the book, and I wound up with 76 out of 150 and thus got into law school. So that's one of the many strokes of great good luck that I've had.
Mm-hmm. That's a good book, too.
It was a good book, as I remember, it was a good book. And law school was uneventful. I sort of toddling along. I think I was probably in the top third of the class, but nothing spectacular. I loved the law. My mentor was late judge of the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court earlier. Meredith, actually called Mid McFarlane. And he was Uncle Mid to me when I was a kid. He and my dad are close friends. And he used to read from Blackstone's commentaries to me, and then he'd get me biographies of great barristers like Sir Edward Carson and Marshall Hall and Birkenhead and so on. I just loved it. So, there we were. That's why I was in law school, and I don't say that I loved law school, but I loved the law.
So he had, when you were quite young, he had, Med McFarlane had piqued your interest.
Very much so. Mm-hmm. Very much so. I just thought the world of him. And we didn't live very far apart from him in the years that I was sort of growing up, at the age where I'd be reading. And I'd go over to his place, and he'd read from Blackstone, tell me that sort of stuff. And it was a pity that I didn't like the practice of law nearly as much as I liked the study of it. So there we were.
You were more of a, do you think you would have been a scholarly kind of?
I doubt it. I'd always had great marks when I'd done any work. But I had sort of a funny time in law school. I seemed to understand what was going on the year after I'd taken it. The light would go on, you know, is what exactly was going on. So I think I only got one first-class mark in law school, and that was torts. The sainted Dr. McIntyre, God, what a guy he was. Everybody loved him. It was his class. Can
I just go back to your undergrad for
sure,
a moment?
Sure, absolutely.
What did you major in, or it was arts?
History and international studies, two things that I liked the most. And I took a lot of histories, even the history of BC, which you'd be interested in.
Walter Sage.
Wonderful, wonderful guy. He really was. And he made the history come to life. I took ancient histories and histories of Rome and Greece and all that kind of stuff.
Was Margaret Ormsby there?
Absolutely. Yet? She taught us medieval history. She was a wonderful lady. I suppose she's gone now.
Yes. Yeah. 1988, I think.
Oh, yeah. No, she was a marvelous lady. As a matter of fact, she was so good that a lot of kids audited her class that weren't in her class at all because she was so good. Yes. Earl Burney was the same way in English, although I didn't take it from him, but he was the same way. People would just go and listen to him.
Mm-hmm. And what about the entrance to law? This was before LSATs. What was the process there? Was it pretty informal?
The process there was half of you were failed in the first year. Mm-hmm. That's what the LSAT was. Mm-hmm. Getting in was no trouble. Staying in was the problem. And we started off with, I think it was 100. And we wound up at the end of the day with 50, at the end of third year with 50. Most of those went in first year. A couple of them went in second year, and only one filled third year. It was Dennis Levy, and it was kind of interesting. When the professor that was prominent in third year was Gilbert Kennedy, who was known for failing people with marks like 8 or 15 or something like that. And you had to have a 55% average. And the year before we went into third year, he failed, or caused a fail, I think, a half a dozen students. And the dean was off in a subconference in Switzerland, I think it was, and Dr. McIntyre arranged for supplemental examinations for these people without a buy-year leave from the dean. And they got through them all, and they got their sheepskins. And when we went into third year, of course, we were all scared shitless because I was married and I had a baby, and McIntyre knew we were all scared, and he came into the class and he said, I want you all to know that if you just keep your nose clean, et cetera, and sail on, you'll get through third year. Remember that I have two courses, just like some others have two courses, which Kennedy did. In other words, what you lose in the swings, you're going to make up in the roundabouts. And then he said, except for you, Mr. Levy. He said, I don't know how you got here this far, but you played the fool through 2 years of law, and if you don't knuckle down, you're not going to make it. And to which Levy just laughed, and he didn't make it.
He didn't.
He didn't. And then I think they gave him another crack at it, and he failed that one, too. And it's too bad. I don't know where Dennis is now. He was an amusing guy and so on, but he just was a different sort of cat. He just played the fool. So that was too bad. That's the only one of us that failed it. I think he's on our class picture. I'm sure he's on our class picture. But he didn't make it.
Who else do you remember of the professors?
Well, let's see. I suppose the most popular one was Ray Herbert, who taught us divorce and taught us English history, history of English law in year one. Dr. McIntyre, as I say, he was just a joy, just a dear. He had his students' interest at heart, and he used a sort of a Socratic method. He would have said to you, Richard, what about this principle? And you'd say something. He'd say, no, what about this? Yeah. And, you know, he had a full class all the time, because he did do that. And we all loved him. Actually, he got me writing an article for the Legal Notes, which it is now called the BC Law Review. And it was on a case called Kruma versus the Queen, where somebody, a young black guy in Kenya, was found with a round of ammunition, which was against the law and a capital offense, and he was sentenced to hang. And the question, the only way they had is the police jumped him and shook it out of him. The issue was whether or not illegally obtained evidence was nevertheless evidence when they came to trial. And so I did a summary of that for the Legal Notes. And I think at the end of the day, it was more Dr. McIntyre's article than it was mine, because he was my editor.
That would have been in the Mau Mau era,
yes,
was it?
Yes, that's right.
And what about your friends? I've got I brought a list of the class. We've talked to Tom Berger.
Yes.
And the person I wanted to ask about was Ron Basford.
Ron Basford, sure.
Because I've worked on on Vancouver Island in the Comox Valley, where I wrote histories of logging, and he was mentioned there as a local boy,
yeah,
as a Courtney kid. Is he still around?
No, he died about 10 years ago, I guess. Ron was an interesting guy. He had a hair disease where all of a sudden the hair fall off in his pillow overnight and he'd be bald. It was too bad that would come back in strings. I don't know why I mentioned that, except that that was one of the unusual things you saw. But he was a hell of a good guy. Matter of fact, I look at the list of this class, and there were just a lot of real great guys and characters and so on. And Ron was one of them. He did very well. He went into Parliament and became a cabinet minister.
He always had a bald look about him. I remember it.
Yeah, that's because he kept losing his hair. Mm. But he was a good guy. He was witty. He was a good guy. He actually ran away with... eloped with one of the male lawyers at the place he wound up at, Davison Company, I think. But at his funeral, his wife led the thing, and she understood, and there it was. And we didn't know that in school, but there it was. But they're looking down the list here, somebody are just good friends of mine. Of course, Tom Burgess sat right behind me, and Tom Braidwood, and Stuart Klein. I've known him all my life. We went to St. George's together. The list goes on and on and on. I could take up all morning just reading those.
Well, he's someone I'd like to talk to more. And we've heard about Klein because he's the son of the
of Jack Klein.
Jack Klein.
Yeah, he was the president of the law school that we were. Chuck Liu ran for vice president. I think it was on the basis he would bring some color to the council.
he must have been one of the first Chinese Canadians.
Yeah, he was. Douglas Jung before him. He was in third year. We were in first year. But
is Chuck Liu still around?
Yes, he is. I'm pretty sure. I've seen him off and on. Chuck had the best of handwriting, and he would take notes, and we would all crib off his notes because he was able to keep them in such a fashion he could read. My big challenge at the end of every year was to read my own writing in case talk. Chuck, he was some of the class scribe. Good guy. Well, lots of others here. So many gone to.
Were you divided into sections, like the later law school?
No.
So it was all one class.
You all said. One class, yeah.
Took every class together?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a funny story. One of my good friends was Bob Guile, and he died about 10 years or so ago. And he and I sat side by side in the front left part of the class. And I mentioned Gilbert Kennedy. His habit was to get a hold of somebody, and then he'd give them a case, Travers versus Hawley or something, and he would stay on them for a whole class, and sometimes carry over to the next day. And we're all horrified when it would come to us. Well, it came to me one day, and I said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Kennedy, or Dr. Kennedy, whatever it was, I have not read the case yet, but I know that Bob Guile has." So he turned on Guile. He kept Kyle going for a class and a half. At the end of it, he said, "You son of a bitch, I'll get you if it takes me the rest of my life." Well, fast forward to our 20th anniversary, and we're up at Capilano all celebrating, and I've been asked to give the sort of keynote address. So I was sitting up in the front row, sitting at a table in the front, and when it came time for the introduction, or for the speech, I was trying to remember who the master of ceremonies was. It doesn't much matter, but in any event, he said, "Now for our most distinguished classmate to give us a talk, etc., etc." By this time, I'm getting up, pulling notes out of my jacket, and it comes to the end of it, he says, "Rendina Hosey." Guile came from the back and said, "I told you, son of a bitch, I'd get you for a lifetime." Oh, I know who was introducing was Jarl Wist, and Jarl did it all in Norwegian. The whole thing in Norwegian until he came to the last part. Jarl just died last August. I practiced with law. Practiced with Jarl actually in Kamloops.
We've heard about Rendina Hosey from someone else, and possibly the from a different year.
Yeah,
someone in a different year. But is she still around?
As far as I know. She married Howie. I'll think of it in a second. Who was became a judge in the end. And last I heard, Rendina was alive and well. And, Hamilton. She married Howie Hamilton and lived in Penticton. And he died. Last I heard, she was still alive. She was a neat lady. She. It was pretty tough being a woman in law school in those days. Unlike today, I think we had three or four, the most. One of them went to jail for murder.
Yeah.
She flunked first year, and so we left her behind.
What happened there? Was it?
Well, as best I remember the story, she was acting for an aging relative. And somehow she smothered the relative. I don't know whether it was because the relative was about to change her will or something like that. I don't know the whole story. But the last name was Harrison. It was Lane Harrison. I can't remember. But in any event, she was found guilty and went to jail. And we had another. No, I'm not going to get into that. We had others who fell by the wayside. But
do you have strong class? Do you still have the class meetings? What are they called?
No, we don't, and that's probably because, well, we were a great class. It's because we're all individualists, you know. And we had our 50th celebration, which would have been lot six, I guess. So, and we had quite a few of the people came back, but No, we haven't. We haven't kept in touch, really.
Is Braidwood still, Tom Braidwood still around?
As far as I know, last I knew him, of course, he was on the Court of Appeal, but I think he retired from that. And I'm not sure he doesn't live up in Squamish or something like that now. But well, Tom was a real good guy. He sat near us in law school. He didn't say much in law school. Most of us tried to avoid being detected. You know? Joel Groberman prided himself on never having had a question asked of him in law school. His head down was the hallway. He became a provincial court judge. May still be for all that.
And what was the curriculum? Was it pretty standard then, or?
I think so. I don't remember them all particularly well, but I remember in first year we took torts, property one, and took a procedure course, took criminal law from Stan Remnant, who was a judge, and what the hell else did we take? We only had, I think, six courses in first year, and then in second year we had a whole pile of them. Property to and equity and procedure and public international law. And, I just don't remember. Oh, and no, like I said, it was administrative law. But no, it's hard to remember them all now. But I do remember one thing very well. On the first day of second year, we came into class. Our first class was equity with Fred Shepard, who was a lawyer from downtown. And he'd already written up about 15 or 20 citations on the blackboard. Citations being what led you to the particular book, which will tell you about the case. And he had them all in the old English ones. And what had happened with the English law, it was published sort of willy-nilly by a number of different sources from time to time. And then along came somebody with a bright idea and put together the one standard in English reports. And they were about, I guess, 40 volumes, but at least it made the citation easier, you know, 1901, and you'll find what you want. This guy, he made us take the old citations and find out how you translated that into the English report case. So it took more damn time to find the case. And he was just that way. But the main rule of equity was that nobody failed equity. Sort of like big books, Bills and Notes. We had a downtown lawyer, Pappy Reed, we called him, I don't know what his first name was. Oddly enough, I wound up as a pallbearer at his funeral because he was in Victoria and he was so old nobody knew him. And I was dragooned by one of the members of the bar to come. That was another road. He didn't lose that. He didn't fail equity. And there was taxation, I remember. That's what got Jack Barbo going. Jack had been just sort of a middling student like most of us until he took income tax. And he got some enormous number, something like 90-some-odd%, which is unheard of in law school. And he wound up being one of Canada's top tax lawyers.
What was his name again?
Barbo.
Jacques
Barbo.
Oh, right. It was the benefactor, the philanthropist. No,
maybe he is. Maybe he is. He married into the Owen family.
Where was the law school then? Well, it was in the same place, but it was an earlier. It's obviously an earlier.
It must have been, Richard. I'm not sure. You know, a lot of people when they come out of university don't want to leave, and they stay behind and do all kinds of things for the university, get involved, and. Their old alma mater, I couldn't get out of there fast enough. And as far as I was concerned, that was behind me. I'd been there 7 years, and it was time to cut the cord. So I'm much more familiar with Simon Fraser, who gave me an honorary doctorate a few years ago, than I am my old place. So I've never been back in law school. I just don't know. I assume it's in the same place.
Yeah. Well, it's about the third version now. And it's
Is it?
Yeah, it's a big...
Right next to the old theological college.
Yeah. It's just opened a new building.
Oh, did they?
A new building, yeah. So what about articling? Did you...
Well, here's where I came a bit of a cropper, Richard. When I graduated, I, as I say, had a wife and family, and I had no money. My father had come on sorry times, and so there was just no money, and it was impossible to exist on $200 a month if you were, you know, a wife and family and so on. So I took a job with Imperial Oil to go to Edmonton. I was going to become an oil tycoon, but I didn't like it. On the way in on May the 15th, the ice was just coming off Wabamun Lake, which I took to be a bad sign. And the first thing I did when I got started with Imperial Oil, a young man took me down to the land titles office to show me how it worked. And I saw these plugs coming out of the woodwork. And I said, "What the hell are those for?" He said, "They're block heaters." I said, "What's a block heater?" He goes, "To keep from block from cracking in the wintertime when it gets cold." And I thought, this is not a good idea. And then it snowed on Labor Day. And I had no job to go to nothing, but I resigned and came back to Vancouver. And I went to work for Canadian White Pine as an assistant safety supervisor. And you can imagine how much I enjoyed that. It wasn't very long before I was fired. And during the period I was looking for work, I ran into a guy I knew in law school a year ahead, a guy named Roy Logie, and he suggested that I get a job at Allstate Insurance as an insurance adjuster. And I did. And it was a very good financial move because I was making $350 a month on each of them, but the being fired by Canadian White Pine overlapped with my start at Allstate, so I actually had 1 week extra pay. So, and then I stayed for nearly four horrifying years at Allstate, hating every single minute of it. And then luck struck, and I've had so many lucky things happen to me. A man who ran a driving range on Sea Island, right near the airport, called me up and said that his pro had quit and was I interested in taking over as his teaching pro. And I would play golf. My golf is a 2-3 handicap at that, 1-2-3 that area. So I said, great. And he said, well, you can make as much as maybe $60 or $70 or more a week doing this. So I did that on weekends and in the evenings. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I decided that I was going to go on an article, and my wife was going to go back to work and this sort of stuff. So I sought articles and went to Guild Ewell and Company and met Mr. Ewell there, who offered me $250 a month. And I said yes, shook hands on it, and I'd hardly get out of the place when I ran into another old friend of mine, Al Helgeson, he was a year ahead of me, I think, in law school. He said, you should go see Tommy Griffiths. He's the sort of a big plaintiff's lawyer, et cetera. He uses juries to relieve insurance companies of their money. And he always pays people with a torts background a little more. So I went up and saw Tommy Griffiths, and he offered me $125 a week to go to $150 a week after 3 months. So I went back and told Mr. Ewell that I wasn't going to be there. He was outraged because he hated Griffiths because Ewell acted for insurance companies. So all of a sudden, when I counted things up, the amount of money I was getting from Tommy Griffiths and the amount I was making on the giving golf lessons put me in a position where I'd be paid a hell of a lot of money for those days. I was probably making $10,000 a year. So away we went. So I articled, and it was an interesting article because Tommy only liked to do injury work, so every other piece of work that came in, incorporating companies or conveyance or whatever it is, I had to do as a student. So I got a pretty wide crowding of things that I would later hate to do. But there we were. I was called to the bar, and I stayed with Tommy for a few months, and then a couple of young people who had been sending their injury cases to Tom on a referral basis asked me if I'd join them, and I would do them, and so I did. And so I stayed in practice in Vancouver until from 1961, through to 1968. Thereafter, I went to Kamloops.
Mm-hmm.
Why to Kamloops? What was that, a professional decision?
It's kind of a strange story. I always loved Kamloops. I was a fly fisherman, tied all my own flies, that sort of stuff. So I love Kamloops. And I'd been up in Penticton playing in the Penticton Open Golf Tournament the previous year. And I mentioned Howie Hamilton. I had a couple of drinks with him, and I said to him, you know, you're so lucky to be up here in the interior, practicing laid-back life, etc. I thought no more about it. And about 6 or 7 months later, I got a call from Yarrow Wist, one of my classmates, and asking me, said, I understand you want to come to the interior. And I said, where did you get that idea? Well, I was talking to Howie Hamilton. He said, we need to have, we didn't call him that in those days, but nowadays, a litigator. We need someone to handle litigation in the firm. Would you be interested? At that time, drugs were just getting into the schools, and I had four kids. Well, only three of them were actually in school at that time. But I just didn't like what I was seeing, and I also thought, I thought it would be a good idea if my kids had a fly rod in their hand sometimes in their life. But more than that, I think, to be honest, I was getting tired of practicing in Vancouver. We were doing all right, but we were always batting our head against the bigger firms, and we never got any of the really good cases. And since I was unwilling to go to any of the big firms, because I'd become an anti-establishment sort of a person, a crank, then I was kind of, I had my eyes open for something else that might come along. And so my then wife and I went up to Kamloops and met Jarl and his two or three colleagues. And next thing I know, that was on a Saturday. Next thing I know, it was on Sunday, we bought a house. Came back and announced to my partners that I was out of there. And so there I was. And I got very lucky there. Am I going on too long?
No, this is perfect. We've got up to 2 hours, so okay. It's great.
All right. I had two sort of lucky things happen. The first thing, I was given a legal aid case, and this guy and two girlfriends had picked up a hitchhiker near, I think it was Little Shuswap, and taken him up there, and they'd hammered him to death, and all there were drugs and everything else imaginable in it. So my job was to defend the male guy, a guy named Huff, H-O-U-G-H, and I went through 13 days of preliminary hearing. Because everything that any of them had mentioned to a policeman had to go into a voir dire to see whether or not it was voluntarily said. So this went on, I guess, 13 days, whatever it was. And eventually, and rightly so, they were committed for trial. And I said to the judge, I consider that I'm now finished with this case, Your Honor. I've done my bit. I've taken the preliminary hearings. And so I want you to know that I'm no longer acting for Mr. Huff. Well, the shit hit the fan big time. I was on national news. I'd abandoned my client and all this sort of crap. The president of the Campbell's Bar Association called a special luncheon to see what they could do to restore the reputation and dignity of the Campbell's Bar. It was all a bunch of bullshit. And anyway, I went to that thing, and I was for lunch. And eventually, it just sort of died down, except about... couple, 3 months later, I got a call to what I go up and see Pete Millward, who was the local bencher in the Law Society. So I went up, and yes, Pete, what's it all about? I said, well, it's my unpleasant duty to reprimand you for your conduct in the Huff case. I said, Peter, it's funny, I don't remember the hearing. When did the hearing take place? He said, oh, we don't do hearings and matters of this sort, just a word to the wise for the bencher. I said, well, you can go fuck yourselves, and so can the benchers. You've got a quarrel with me. Cite me. If you don't have one, then just bug off.
So what was the issue exactly?
The issue was that I should have stayed on after the preliminary hearing and gone through the trials and presumably the appeals for what was a princely sum of $50 a day. And quite frankly, nobody could afford to do $50 a day if you're contributing to a partnership. So I went back to my office, and to the horror of my partners, I wrote a letter to the treasurer, they called him, John Bouck, B-O-U-C-K, whom I'd known very well, and told him exactly that. If you've got a quarrel, and issue a citation, and we'll deal with it. Otherwise, just bugger off and leave me alone. And I went down to Vancouver a couple of months after that, kind of having forgotten all this, and I ran into John at the courthouse, and I said, John, do I assume that the Huff case is all behind us, and He said, Rafe, none of us are behind us. We've changed our position. No longer we're going to have the benches do that. You were quite right. If the Law Society's got something to say, it should say it officially to you. Otherwise, if you demolish that. So that, I had that, and that got me a lot of prominence in the press. I mean, people knew me. I'd already been there for 6 months, and you know, most of the people in town knew who the hell I was. And then with the late, only recently late Peter Jensen, we had a case of a bottomless dancer. This was supposed to be highly illegal and all the rest of it. And I acted for the cabaret she performed in, and Peter Jensen acted for the girl, or the lady herself. And we decided the only way to deal with this was just make mockery of it. Technically she was going to be found guilty, so we're going to make the Crown look awfully bad in this thing, see how it works out. And we had just the right judge, Judge Stuart Van Mail, and he's dead now, but he was one of these guys with a great sense of humor and a great dislike of bullshit. So it was an extraordinary trial. The courtroom was packed day after day, and there were some amusing parts. The principal constable, I think, was probably only about 20 years of age, and so he gave us evidence that the lady had exposed her genital region. And so Peter got up, and he'd had a G-string with hair on it made. And so he said, now, could she have been wearing a genital hairpiece? And that sort of laughed. And then I got a hold of Xavier Hollander's The Happy Hooker. And the whole question was the standards of the community. So I read to this poor constable the part where she gets screwed by her Alsatian dog out in a pool in South Africa. And I said, now, how does this compare to the standards of this community center? But the pièce de resistance came, and we qualified some lady as an expert on dancing. And I can see her now. In any event, she got up and gave the dubious evidence that the only obscene dancing was ballroom dancing, because that's the only time you touch one another. So in any event, we'd set her down, and we're moving on, and suddenly the light went on with Peter, and he tugged and said, we got to get in that German. So he did, and he said, I got to bring that constable back. I really got something going here. So fine, the judge gave him, had the constable back on the stands. And Peter said, have you ever seen that witness, whatever her name was? No, never in your life before, no. He said, I put it to you, constable, that there is a full-length, full-nude picture of her on the barracks of the RCMP right downstairs from here. And there was a bunch of babbling. And of course, Van Mills, I got to see this. Sudanius, and there she is. Snarkers. I mean, the whole thing became a great farce. And at the end of it, we had asked the judge to postpone his decision until a Supreme Court of Canada was hearing a case on all fours of this one. And he did for a while. But after about 5 weeks, he could contain himself no longer. And so he gave judgment, and he just excoriated the Crown, the police, everybody imaginable. But then felt he had to find her guilty and find her $1. So we went out, and the media were all over us, aren't we pleased, etc. We said, no, we're appealing it. And he can't appeal. Yes, we can. Well, very shortly thereafter, the Supreme Court of Canada did come down, and they did rule in our favor. So in those days, a case from the lower court in criminal law went to the county court for a new hearing, a trial de novo. And, of course, we just went in there, and the prosecutor called no evidence, and so they were discharged. And the only lingering memory I have now is that Peter won the toss for the check for $1 that came back. So, and I tell you all that because I'd only been in Kamloops, 3 years? Going on four. When I ran for city council and was elected. And from there, I sought and got the Sokin nomination. And went into the legislature and went into cabinet for 5 years. But there's no question about those two law cases got me well known. You know, the papers, the last one, it was just I still laugh when I think of this next weekend. I mean, a lot of judges would have just heaved us all on our ass. You know? It was great fun.
What was the name of the hotel that wasn't Vancouver?
It was a cabaret called Friar Tuck's Cabaret. And it's gone now, I'm sure. But the estimable Liz Bigger was the one who owned it. And, it was funny.
So was that your first interest in politics, or had you said in the war you had been, as a kid, you had been
interested? I had a lot of interest, but I never seemed to see the opening to get involved. And I got involved in minor ways. I worked for the Liberal Party federally and did some stuff. I think I was agent for one of the MPs who ran in Richmond, but I had never got, you know, sort of down and dirty into politics until then.
Mm-hmm. So when was this, the SOCRED nomination, in the 60s?
This was on St. Patrick's Day, 1975. The election was December the 11th, I think it was, 75.
And you won, obviously.
I won. I don't know whether I should tell you the story, but I think you can decide to excise it or not as you wish. I had become part owner of the Cherry Creek Ranch, and one summer's day in 1975, I was down at some do, I don't know, it was branding or whatever the hell it was. I didn't know anything about ranching. I just was in there with someone as an investment. And I had far, far, far too much to drink. And I drove my car home, and I got to the top of the hill in Kamloops. I fell asleep. I crossed two lanes of traffic on the highway, three lanes, over an embankment, down into a used car lot, hitting some of the cars that went by. And coincidentally, I acted for that car lot. They were my clients. And the police arrived, and I was so drunk I couldn't talk. And I'd had the presence of mind to put my driver's license in my shirt pocket. So I gave it to them. And after a while, the constable said, do you think you can drive home, Mr. Mayor? And I got yes out. And I somehow got that car home. Now, if I had been charged, I would have, of course, lost my nomination. That would have been taken away from me. So I never got into the legislature. I never got into radio or any of those sort of things. So on these slender bits of luck, a hell of a lot sometimes results. And that was the luckiest thing, I think, apart from meeting Wendy, that was the luckiest thing that I ever had happened in my life. It shouldn't have happened. I mean, I should have been just carted off to jail and spent the night there, et cetera. But
well, in a later era, I'm sure you would have been.
Oh, I'd have lost my car, all kinds of things. I mean, those were the days when drinking and driving was considered kind of funny. You know, you'd go into the office on Monday and say, oh, I was so shit-faced on Saturday night, I had to one eyes closed and the other one watching, you know, that kind of stuff. And when I was practicing law, the unofficial margin was 1.5. You know, if you were below 1.5, you were okay. So, and it was entirely different. And as a matter of fact, in 1976, one of my daughters was killed in a car accident. She was driving, I've been drinking. And I don't want to get into that too much, but I've often felt that if I and my wife, but I particularly had shown a better example, maybe that wouldn't have happened. You know. But let's leave that one. I don't want to. I get pretty upset with her.
Sure. And so you're all of a sudden you're in Victoria, and
yes.
Now in 76. So this is the Bennett Jr. Bill Bennett government.
Yes.
So it's the NDP era ended in 75. 72 to 75,
that's
Dave
correct.
Barrett.
That's correct.
So you're in the, where you, did you have a cabinet post? Or?
I went into cabinet immediately. A very small ministry, the smallest of the works, called Consumer Services, which at that time, about the only thing it had going for it was the wage and price controls and rent control that required any kind of thinking. And it was expanded in November of 1976 into Consumer and Corporate Affairs, which really gutted the entire Attorney General's Ministry that didn't involve the administration of law. All of the stock exchange companies, real estate, on and on, well, they all came into this new ministry. And I hired a fascinating guy named Tex, and it's just like you would think, Enemark, E-N-E-M-A-R-K, as my deputy. And he and I had a ball. We brought in 22 pieces of legislation in the consumer field. One of them was to license motor dealers. I had six of them in my caucus all screaming like wounded eagles, we're going to do this, but we did. And forced the national banks to obey BC law. They refused to obey our consumer laws, and so we got them to the edge of the courtroom, and they folded. We tightened up on the stock exchange. We brought in the Travel Agents Registration Act to help people that were stranded in Hawaii or wherever it was, usually older people, because the airline had gone broke. And it just went on and on. It was a great time. We totally revamped all the liquor laws. Do you remember the beer parties?
Yep, with the ladies and...
Ladies and escorts only?
Yep.
Well, we got rid of that. And it was kind of interesting how it happened. In 1978, there was a second beer strike in 2 years. And the beer parties had always wanted to be able to serve hard liquor. We politically, that just wouldn't have happened then. But in any event, they really got upset with this, and you told us to serve hard liquor or we're not going to survive, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, to make a long story short, Tex and I devised a new license, and this would be called the pub license, not neighborhood pub license. And if any hotel that gussied up its premises and put in a 125-seat with 25 standees, pub in their hotel, in other words, change the decor of their pub, bearing in mind the standards would be different in Vancouver than, say, Clean-A-Clean, then we would give them a license and they could sell all the hard liquor they wanted to. So they immediately cried that this was blackmail, it was extortion. I went to Kamloops and the two guys that ran the Clearwater Hotel, I forget their names now, Marcenuk, M-A-R-C-E-N-I-U-K, came down to see me with blood in their eye. When I finally got a chance to talk, I said, well, George, how many people do you have in your pub on an average night? 20, 25, 30. And how many women come in? Not very many. And I said, well, how would you like to have a place where 125 could come in and they would come because they'd serve hard liquor and their wives would come because they would never go near a beer parlor? And they sat there and they looked just blank at me for a while. And George, did you know? I think the minister's got a point. Let's look at this a little longer. Well, the light went on for all of them pretty quickly. They said, well, this is a hell of an idea. So the vast, vast majority of them did exactly that. So the beer parlor just disappeared off the face of the earth. There may be one or two of them left as relics. I don't know. But certainly the beer parlor was no longer in existence in any real way. So we had a lot of fun doing that sort of stuff. The banks was particularly fun. They, in BC, as in other places, they have a seize or sue clause in the Conditional Sales Act, which simply means if you default, the bank or the company, whatever it is, can either take back the vehicle or they can sue you for the money you owe, but not both. And the banks consistently were doing both, and every time they did it, we would provide a lawyer to the driver or the owner, whoever it was. And the bank would just drop it when that happened. And for the first year or so, we're too busy on other things. We finally got them in our sights, and we decided that we're gonna take them to court. So Tex and I were at the annual legislative reporters Christmas party, and they're supposed to be completely confidential. We all had a little bit too much to drink, I guess, and I told one of the reporters what we were about to do and what I thought of these pricks in every imaginable name. Well, the following day, the Vancouver Sun headline was this story, Mayor accuses banks of deceit, et cetera, et cetera. And Len Norris, a cartoonist, had a great cartoon on this in the paper. I got a call from Bill Bennett, who's, this is Christmas time, he's in Kelowna, and he said, "What have you done now, Mayor?" So I told him, he said, "God almighty, wouldn't you mind giving me a little advance notice when you're going to do these things? I got every banker in town is knocking on my door." So in any event, they came in to see me one day, case I think had been set for hearing. And the guy who was the spokesman for him, what the hell's his name, Patillo, Arthur Patillo, used to be the chairman of the Toronto Stock Exchange. He was the bank spokesman. He came in and said, Minister, you're right, we surrender. And we'll do that. So we've just got one problem. We have all these forms, and we want to have time to run out and put in new ones. And Tex said, "How long do you want?" He said, 6 months. Tex said, "You got 3. And he'd taken a lot of shit in this thing all the way through it. So that was his answer he did. So it was just one of those things after the other. And, of course, in this time, I was the representative for the province on constitutional matters, which during the run-up to the Constitution coming back from Westminster. So you haven't asked, but I'm going to tell you, I consider Bill Bennett to be the best premier British Company's ever had, including his father. Hmm. And I think if you want to argue that, just look at what we've had since, and that'll tell you. And he was a superb guy to work with. He never backdoored you. You never found out on the evening news what you're going to be doing the next day. If you made a mistake, it was dealt with in private. He had an unbelievable sense of humor, which never showed when he was in public. He would have us in stitches, like in cabinet sometimes. But everybody in that cabinet with me would have crawled on their hands and knees for a mile over broken glass for Bill Bennett. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you go anywhere, they'll tell you the same thing. He was just a super guy to work for, a great premier. He's now very sick, unfortunately. And there he is, 4 months younger than me, and he said,
And did you keep up the law practice when you were in the tour?
No, I had my partners and I had about 6 months before hammered out what would happen under various circumstances. If I lost, there was no problem, of course. If I was elected and the opposition, then that was one thing. If I was elected and I was on the government side, that was yet another. If I was elected and I was in the cabinet, then that was another one too. And if that happened,
what the hell's that?
Like, this is the best man. Where was I?
Yes.
And so we just met one Saturday, just before I was taken into cabinet, and just signed the agreement. We'd already hammered it out, and so on. I left. They kept the name, and they were entitled to do so. It's now called Mayor Jensen Blair. And the last time I practiced law was December the 11th, 1975, but the name's still there. So.
And how long did that political career last?
It lasted until the beginning of 1981, when I resigned to take up a radio show with, what was that, 600, CJOR 600. And that came as a bulldog. Do you want me to tell you how that happened?
Yeah.
I've been on Jack Webster's show, and I was one of the 4 or 5 people that Bennett would let go on Webster's show. And Jack and I always had a good spirited discussion. And this one day, we decided to go, before lunch, we decided to go across the street to Hotel Vancouver and to have lunch in the Timber Room, I think it was called. So as we got into the restoratives, he said to me, "You don't look like you're really enjoying politics." And so after determining it was off the record, I said, "Well, not really, Jack. I've done everything I want to do. I've had no desire to become the Attorney General ever. And the Premier's job isn't open." So he said, "Well, I think that you should try radio." "Well, why would I try radio?" "Well, you're a good guest, and I think that you'll do well." So next thing I know, I get a phone call from that evening when I got back to Victoria saying, "I want you to go and talk to Mel Cooper of CFAX as soon as you can." I said, "God, Jack, one of the reasons I don't like politics is I hate living in Victoria." He says, "Do what you're told, you dumb bugger. Just do what you're told." So I went and saw Mel Cooper, and Mel referred me to Jimmy Pattison, whom I never met. Next thing I know, I'm in Pattison's office, and he asked me if I'd be interested, and I said, well, I'm interested, you know, to hear what you have to offer. He said, well, I'm not going to get into that, but my manager and my program manager would like to see you, and can you do that? I think this was in the early morning. Can you do that this afternoon? Well, he said, sure. So I went and met the two of them, Al Anaka, A-N-A-K-A, and Frank Callahan, C-A-L-L-A-G-H-A-N. He was the program director. So they said they very much like to have me at center. What would I require as money? And I said $100,000 a year, a lot of money those days. And they blanched, and I said, well, look, I make about just under $80,000 a year as a cabinet minister. I'm taking a hell of a chance, and unless I can have, you know, the thought that I'm going to be well provided for, so that when a few fire me, I got tied up or something. But anyway, to make a long, long story short, they came back with an offer of $75,000 going up to such and such if my ratings were this and that. And I said, no, just $100,000 no matter what. And he said, well, a 3-year contract. I said, no, a 1-year contract, because if I'm any good, I want to be able to renegotiate. If I'm bad, you'll get rid of me anyway. You'll find a way to cast me aside. So away we went. And I told Bill about it. This is at Christmas time. And in 1980, I called Bill and told him what had happened. And he was good. He said, I'll meet you on Boxing Day. I think it was the day after Boxing Day. I'll fly back down from Kelowna, and we could meet in my office and talk about it. So he came down, and he said, does your office have a liquor cabinet? I said, is the Pope Catholic? He said, so let's go to your office. So we went and had a couple of drinks of scotch, and eventually he said to me, well, you know, you're going to stay on as an MLA, and I said, yes, I plan to. He said, well, good luck, we're going to miss you in the cabinet room, but good luck. So I guess it was after I'd announced that I was leaving and saying that I was going to stay on as MLA, Alan Garr and a couple of others came to me and said, Rafe, you know, you can't possibly be both an MLA and be somebody who's criticizing the government. I said, beside that, you're going to have to miss every Friday session, because the Friday sessions in the morning. And I thought about it, I thought they're right, there's no question about that. So I got a hold of Bill Bennett, told him I was going to have to leave the legislature. And he was horrified, because we only had, I think, a 5-seat majority at that particular time. In any event, he sent a good friend of his, Hugh...
Curtis.
No, Hugh, he wasn't in the legislature. I'll think of it in a minute. In any event, he... came over to my place, and we sat with a bottle of scotch on the table, and we talked about this. And he was trying to get me to stay, of course, and I said, I just can't do it. And he was going to stay overnight with us, and so finally it was time for bed, and I toddled off and got down the next morning. There was a note on the kitchen table. He decided to go back home, and that he was going to tell Bill Bennett that I was right, that I couldn't handle it. And that was that. I resigned from the legislature just before I went on the air, and there we were. But I still feel pretty badly about letting the constituency down. However, that worked out well. The Socreds won my seat in the by-election, so there was no change in that. So to that extent, it was fine.
Who took over that seat?
Bob Richard.
Right, yeah.
The memory goes. I'll think of something along the line here.
So you were with CFAX at first in Victoria?
No. I wasn't clear on that. No, Cooper sent me over to Jimmy Pattison, and they had an opening at CJOR in Vancouver. They were going to move Pat Burns out of there in the evening time, wanted me in the morning. And I learned very early what a class act radio stations are. Pat Burns found out about this on his 10 o'clock news after I'd given him the press release. Nobody told him at all. And I'll show you what kind of guy he was. The morning went on the air, just before I went on, I went to the desk with the lady, and I said, you better pick up the phone if somebody wants to talk to you. I picked up, he says, Mayor, he says, break a leg, kid. You're going to do fine. Just break a leg. Said, don't try to be me or anybody else. Be yourself. You'll be fine. So there we are.
I need to have a car. I need to get out now. Sure.